This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Professor and our curriculum director at DMH, Dr. Brown, welcome.
Thank you.
So what we're going to talk about today is one of the more important, not necessarily forgotten, but often overlooked periods in the U.S. military's history, what's known as the New Look during the Eisenhower years. So let's start by talking about both the man and kind of the era. The U.S. has just won World War II, Eisenhower is one of the great heroes. And then the U.S. kind of wanders into Korea, which is a war that, you know, has lots of aspects that a lot of people are uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
So what is Eisenhower doing between this 45 to 52 period before he really runs for president?
Yeah. Well, he's going to take a turn at Chief of Staff of the Army, which is a job that should be kind of the pinnacle of his military career. But what he's doing as Chief of Staff is cutting the army to the bone, because right. You have the post-World War II demobilization. And then he leaves uniform service. It's kind of weird. As general of the army, he doesn't retire. There's no way for him to be on the retired rolls, but he's no longer in active service. But he's always able to be called by the president, as we'll find out later. And then he is president of Columbia University for a time. And the reason he does that is he sees the influence that the United States could have, but not just from a military perspective, but from more of a values and ideals. And so one of the things that he tries to do when he's president of Columbia University is get U.S. students a broader perspective. And there are some aspects of, especially in the late 1940s, anti-communism, McCarthyism is getting early 1950s, but there's some of that skepticism even when he's president of Columbia about books like Das Kapital in the library. Can you believe that U.S. students have right. that, or that professors are teaching this? And Eisenhower's position is, well, of course they should, because these are ideas and our students should understand the ideas so they can understand the flaws in the ideas. And so he sees his mission at Columbia University as a way to bring this global perspective that he understands from his experience in the Army to the educational mission.
So it's fair to say he's kind of, he's not certainly pro-communist, he's an anti-communist, but he's also yes. kind of an anti-McCarthyite.
Yeah, he is. The question is, how best do you... You can be anti-communist without being a McCarthyist.
Yeah, without banning books from the library.
Yeah, right, right. And so the question is, like, how do you operate in that space? And that's one of the interesting things. When he gets into office, there are some landmines, right?
Right.
So while he's president of Columbia, you start to have some of the rumblings of that post-World War II second Red Scare. Mm-hmm. And his position is, more information is better. We should be encountering these ideals, because if we pretend like they don't exist, then we're not going to be well prepared to offer a defense.
So it sounds almost like there's a class distinction where you have Eisenhower, the elite university president, saying, let's understand these ideas, let's read about them, and McCarthy, kind of the populist, saying, no, burn the books.
Yeah. I don't know if Eisenhower would have seen himself necessarily in that class distinction.
Yeah, there's an irony.
Yeah, there is, because he's not of that Columbia University space. And in fact, he feels a little out of place, because he wants to be a president of a university, but of course the faculty, their first question is, well, why are you here? What's yeah, given you...
Where's your PhD?
Yeah, which of course he doesn't have that. I mean, he has a bachelor's degree, but he never goes to graduate school. It's a little bit different. He goes to the War College, he goes to the Industrial War College, but he doesn't get master's degrees as we do today in professional military education. And so it's not necessarily that he feels ill-qualified or unqualified. It's more that he is differently qualified. And he does try to win them over to his side. And he makes some good connections there. But there's also a contingent of the faculty that just doesn't like having a general who is there over the university.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's now, as far as like the reason why I don't think he views it as a classist thing, although I do think that there's a lot into that because Columbia is not known for being a university of the people, but it's that he starts the people-to-people program, and that continues today through his family. But you try to get these international connections, and he thinks that Columbia is a place that he can use some of those resources that a university like that would have to create this a internationalist view in these young college-age students. His brother also had been a president of two universities by that time, so Milton. Mm. And so there's, but Milton had a PhD. So
yeah.
Milton,
he's qualified.
Yeah, he's like I said, differently qualified. Yeah. So
wait, Eisenhower's kind of hanging out in academia during this period. It's worth pointing out, this is really before the GI Bill hits. Universities are still very elite.
Yeah.
So what would you say are Eisenhower's kind of foreign policy principles at this point, before he becomes president?
Yeah, internationalism. Collective security is something that he saw work well in World War II, and he doesn't like the demobilization in terms of how it was done. He understands that you have to do it, but you can cut smartly instead of just cutting to cut. Mm. What he doesn't want is an isolationist. And we'll see, that's going to be one of the things that's going to drive him into politics in the early 1950s. But post-World War II, what he's doing in Columbia is trying to foster this internationalist spirit in the student body specifically, but also more broadly in U.S. culture. Because what he doesn't want is for the United States to do what they did after World War I, which is, okay, we solved your problem, and we're going to go back. We don't really care about this. Yeah. League of Nations doesn't work out. United Nations, very different. The United States has an active role in it. He supports it. Mm-hmm. He wants the United States to be a global player. The question is, how?
Right.
Because it's not going to be in a military sense. And I think one of the things you talked about in the intro is the Korean aspect is a little overlooked, but also we tend to conflate the mobilization for Korea, which is global, with what happens after World War II. Mm-hmm. In 45 to 50, the United States is really withdrawing a lot. We've got occupation forces in Germany. We've got occupation forces in Japan and also in other places. But those are occupation forces. They're not forward deployed. And when we think about the Cold War, oftentimes we say, okay, well, end of World War II in 45, beginning of Cold War in 45, and this is not true.
Yeah.
45 through, 48-ish, there's really a lot of the United States militarily removing itself. 48, you start to have some of the problems in the Soviet Union not doing what it's supposed to do as far as turning Europe back over to Europeans. And that's going to start a bigger conversation about how the United States should be international.
Mm-hmm.
What Eisenhower is doing in Columbia is trying to approach this from an educational and values perspective. And then, as we'll see, he's going to get pulled into the military first and then broader politics.
So would you say his internationalism at this stage is kind of the Woodrow Wilson type, where he just wants to be a European great power? Or is it truly international? Is he giving equal weight to places like Asia and Africa?
Okay, and this is anachronistic, but from his perspective, and I think that there's a good economic view for that, Europe is the center of gravity, and that is where the productive potential is for both U.S. markets, but also for economic growth. Sometimes in 21st century, we can look at the world and say, well, look at China, right? China's a huge economy. The Chinese economy after World War II is nothing like what it is now. Africa is going through decolonization, and Africa still struggles economically to realize its potential.
Right.
That's even more dramatic in this post-World War II period, because you still have a lot of colonial influence. You still have a lot of just trying to shake free of colonialism. And so when you're looking at what the economic realities are, where the United States trade happens, it's Europe. And so it's not to the exclusion of those things. It's more Eisenhower is looking at things from an economical perspective. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to get markets going, if you're going to get productivity going, if you're going to meet people's material needs, you have to do that where it makes economic sense, which is Europe. It's not that he's unconcerned with what's happening in Asia. It's just that if you don't solve the problem in Europe, mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter what's going to happen in Asia. There's not as much talk in Africa just because as we get to the end of the 1940s, we'll see what Britain is going to do that's going to force the U.S. to make some decisions, mainly in the Middle East and Egypt.
Yeah.
But sub-Saharan Africa is really not strategically a matter of discussion mm-hmm. at all. There's going to be some discussion about North Africa, specifically Egypt and the Middle East, but that's right. more in a context of the British withdrawing. But 45 to kind of 48, the British still haven't admitted that there is no return right. to power.
Right.
And so they're trying to hold on, you know, for grim death. But yeah, Africa's not important as far as getting the world economy back going. And China, as we know, 45 to 49, you've got the resumption of the Chinese Civil War, and the U.S. is going to be in the process of asking itself that weird question, how did we lose China?
Right, right, if, right, right, right. Yeah. Yeah, as we've talked about in a prior podcast. So one last kind of background question. Eisenhower, he's watching these foreign policy discussions. Frederick Lojval makes a really good argument that Franklin Roosevelt was a decolonialist and Truman was not because he was more of an anti-communist. Yeah. Where does Eisenhower fit on that?
Oh. yeah. I think what Eisenhower wants is for people to be able to make their own decisions. And how do you do that in a way that accords with his own values? Mm-hmm. And there's that tension there, right? That if you look at what's happening in a place like Indochina, where French colonialism is brutal and the decolonization is not, it's never elegant, but to say that it is inelegant, right?
Right, right. And same with the Dutch in Indonesia.
Yes.
It's just brutal fighting.
Yeah. And the Viet Minh do have at least a plurality of support, especially compared with what the French offer in some type of a French union that wouldn't be in any sense autonomy.
Right.
Or those folks that worked for the French but now want to be part of a self or a home rule, that really doesn't resonate. But the Viet Minh are communist. And right. so you see that tension where when people make their own choice, but that choice doesn't align with Eisenhower's understanding of individual liberty, of something that is not communist, that's where there's a tension there. But he does not think that the U.S. should be underwriting the continuation of imperialism. Mm. The risk, though, is it seems to be a zero-sum game as you're getting into decolonization, and that there aren't that many decolonialization projects that are moving to liberal democracy.
Right.
And I think that sometimes we can forget the fact that the United States has that special relationship with Britain, all well and good, but they're an empire trying to hold on to it.
Right.
We need France for European security. As we already talked about, Europe is the center of gravity for U.S. foreign relations at this time. Mm-hmm. To get them to help with European security, you also have to do some things to help them maintain a sense of what France is, which is empire. And
right.
so you find yourself in these awkward situations that you don't want to further imperialism, but you also don't want to surrender these people to communist oppression. And that's something that also gets lost, is it's not as if these decolonization projects then come and they say, okay, well, this is going to be the ideal communist project. These are still authoritarian governments that are
right.
oppressive to their people.
Yeah.
And so it's not as if the people have a wild flourishing of individual liberty and economic freedom.
Right.
But we also have to make some uncomfortable decisions.
Right.
Yeah, that's so, a long way of not answering your question.
No, that's a good description of a fascinating period. Let's speed forward to the early 50s. Now we have Korea that breaks out, kind of catches most people off guard in America, certainly.
Yeah.
We also have the kind of flailing of the Truman presidency with a bad economy, with, people thought he was going to lose the 48 election, right?
Yes.
So
people thought he was going to lose a prior election for Senate before that.
Yeah, he's true. How does this all play for Eisenhower? How does the war in Korea play? How does Truman himself play with Eisenhower?
Well, so and I we will get to that. One thing that happens before then, though, 48, the Soviet Union is not playing nicely. Mm-hmm. What's supposed to happen, according to Potsdam, according to Yalta, is all of these occupied European countries are supposed to get their own say in their future governments. And where the U.S. and the British and the French are the major occupying powers, that happens a little bit more straightforward manner. Of course, with the caveat, they are not, it would not be acceptable for them to choose communist governments.
Right. Right.
But the elections there are generally more open, and they have a much wider variety of people participating. Mm-hmm. You do have socialist parties, communist parties in those countries that are running. So it's not as if, well, the U.S. is doing the same thing the Soviets are going to do, just in a different way. That's not the case.
Yeah, I think in both Italy and France, the majority is socialist communist until
yes.
late in the decade.
Yes, they are. And that's a weird distinction that means something for those populations, but when you go across the Atlantic, means it's a distinction without a difference.
Right.
But what we don't do is force those folks out of the governing process. We do have some clandestine efforts to make sure they don't increase their share in government.
Right.
That's, you know, would be distasteful from our perspective today. But anyway, what's happening in Eastern Europe is the Soviets refuse to allow anyone other than their approved parties to participate in elections. And of course, all of those approved parties are going to be communist parties. And then the real problem is Germany. And neither side, we think this division of Germany is planned, and it's not. It is an awkward compromise that happens and then ossifies, and then decades later people wonder, how do we ever get there?
Right.
But especially in the immediate aftermath, the question is, how do you give Germany back to the Germans? And, you know, there's a Morgenthau plan where we're gonna carve it up so it's never powerful again. But nobody wants that, because if you're the Soviets, you want Germany back. You want that market productive. You want it on your side. Of course, if you're the United States, if you're Britain and you're France, you want Germany unified. You want that market, and you want it on your side. Both sides don't want to militarize Germany, though, especially kind of 48 to 40, 45 to 48. Nobody's talking about militarizing Germany, especially France. They don't want it.
Right.
The Soviets don't want it. But that doesn't mean that because nobody wants to split it, that it's not going to be split. So you do have the occupation zones, which are planned based on the River Elbe, where it just makes sense. It's a natural barrier for those World War II forces to come. Mm-hmm. But that's going to leave the problem of Berlin, because nobody wants to give up Berlin.
Right.
So you've got Berlin that's, you know, split between the Allies. As you start to get to the latter part of it, kind of the 47, 48, what the United States, France, and Britain are doing is they're governing their occupied zone more together, mm-hmm. more cooperatively. They're going to try to do a currency reform. You've got the Marshall Plan, where the Western European states are invited to. The Central and Eastern European states, to include the Soviet Union, are invited to participate. The problem is it's all going to be denominated in U.S. dollars. And it requires some internal market reforms that align you closer to capitalist policies. Makes sense for the United States. However, Stalin sees that as the camel's nose under the tent. We're not going to do it. It also, you know, we think of the Marshall Plan and, okay, we're just dumping tons of money. Yeah, but we're also selling them manufacturing equipment so that they can rebuild their factories. But we're also selling them technical expertise. We're selling them our manufacturing philosophy, as it were.
Yeah.
And that goes against what the Soviets want.
They're not dedicated Taylorists?
No, they're not. And so Stalin, and I think sometimes we look at the Marshall Plan as an altruistic act, and certainly there's some of that, because there's famine after World War II, and the United States is really worried that if you don't address these material concerns, people are going to go to communism.
Right.
Because the propaganda getting out of the Soviet Union is that things are, they are better than they are in Western Europe, which is not hard to do, but it's also a lie, but you don't know that.
Right.
And so what's happening in Europe, 48, Western European countries start to realize they have to do something, and they have to do it collectively. The Western European Union, which is a military part of it, but there's also going to be increasing economic cooperative efforts, which, of course, we'll see mature into the European Union at some point in time. Mm-hmm. But for the United States, we're kind of taking this wait-and-see approach. There's the Rio de Janeiro Treaty that we have in our hemisphere that's a collective security treaty where we are going to underwrite the collective security of folks in our hemisphere. And that works out well. The Europeans want something similar, but what the United States doesn't want to do is just continue to underwrite security of all these different regions. We want them to have skin in the game. So what does that look like? Well, it's the European Defense Community, which is this pan-European army, and the Brits are going to have their forces, the French, they've got their forces. Both have rapidly demobilized, but they're starting to realize you have to have something.
Right.
But then the question is, well, what do the Benelux countries do? What does Germany do? Nobody wants them. And so there's this idea that, well, we can like have German troops, but nothing over a battalion. There won't be any senior German officers. And then hopefully we can get to a point where you don't necessarily wear the flag of your country. Like you're all your, but it doesn't make sense. And so nothing really happens. The Berlin blockade is a shot across the bow for the United States. And that's when we really kind of perk up and realize, okay, something serious is going on. And that is going to lead to us signing what's going to become the Washington Treaty, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Eisenhower's going to get a new job as you get into this mobilization for Korea. It's for Korea. We're going to send a couple divisions there, but we're going to send four divisions to Europe. Mm. And that's why you need Eisenhower in the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe position.
So he's called back into uniform?
He is, yeah. President calls, and of course, he's out of uniform, but he's a general of the Army, and he comes and answers the call of his nation. He also thinks the mission's important. And it's not, you know, you talk about Truman being in disarray. Eisenhower agrees with mobilizing to help Korea. Eisenhower agrees with what the Truman administration is doing. What he's frustrated with, because he goes down shortly after the start of the war, he goes down to the Pentagon and he tries to see Bradley, tries to see some other senior leaders, and he gets the sense that they don't understand how serious this really is, because people aren't talking about mass mobilization. No. They're talking about moving some troops some places, and he's like, no, this is serious. War after World War II for Eisenhower is, if you're going to fight it, we need to do it. I hate to say, you know, large-scale combat operations, but
right. He's
and it's really because he thinks that the stakes are too high. We haven't talked about the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
But for him, that is a delineation. There is warfare before, and then there's warfare after. And in 1950, remember, the Soviets are an atomic power now. And so what he's looking at is not just there's some peripheral conflict started by the North Koreans in a place that nobody cared about.
Right.
This is something that could be bigger. Is it a feint that if we go and completely mobilize and fight in Korea to the expense of Western Europe, that the Soviets are going to move in and
so
expand?
So if we put like for the four divisions in Korea and leave two in Europe, then the Soviets will take advantage, that kind of thing?
That kind of, exactly, yes. And there, it is really controversial to get the four divisions in Europe. Because, and we'll talk about this a little bit, before he goes, there's Senator Robert Taft, who is Mr. Republican.
Passed the Taft-Hartley Act.
Yes. But he's also, you know, Mr. Republican, but not popular.
Yeah.
And if you look at who the Republicans put on the ticket in the two elections before, the governor of New York, Dewey, yeah, he at least had some good name recognition. People know Taft, but they don't necessarily like.
He's kind of a plutocrat, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, he comes from an influential family,
yeah,
right?
And the Taft-Hartley Act essentially broke labor unions.
Yes, yeah. So he is not a man of the people.
No,
and
he's a man of management.
Yes. So, but he is the guy, and he's not just the guy for his domestic policies. You were talking about the economic aspects of the Republican Party at the time. He's also part of this isolationist wing, and that's probably a little too strong. Mm-hmm. It's not that they don't think the United States should be doing things around the world. It's how should the United States be doing them? Why should the United States be sending four divisions that it's going to have to make?
Right.
You know, you don't have a whole lot of combat power. Why should we be spending money, sending those divisions to Europe, when what are the Europeans doing? We're sending those four divisions because Europe doesn't have four divisions.
Right.
And that's one of the big concerns. But there's just the reality of the fact that you don't have military forces there. The Soviets, and again, back to propaganda, they never demobilize. What we don't know is they've got their units that are doing agricultural duty and harvesting. And even though they are, you know, stood up divisions, so to speak, they are hollow. They're not combat ready. They're not able to fight. We don't know that, though. All we know is the Red Army doesn't demobilize. We know what we've done. And so you've got this bifurcation in U.S. politics that, mm-hmm, for the Democrats, you've got to be forward deployed. You've got to fight because this is what U.S. security demands. It also is what the United States needs to do to be a good partner. If you don't help the South Koreans, then how can you expect the Western European countries to believe in your promise of security? From the Republican side, yeah, all that's well and good, but at the end of the day, we're spending money we don't have. We're just coming out of a recession, hopefully. What is this going to do to our economy? If our economy doesn't work, this whole global project doesn't work.
Right.
Because you don't have the European economy making enough or really providing enough of a market for U.S. goods.
Yeah.
We already talked about the fact that the Asian economy, such as it is not what it is in the 21st century, but in 1950, it's communist. And you don't have the trade. We don't realize there's not a lot of trade between the United States and Soviet economies. You're going to see some of that as you get to some thawing. But you've got Tito and Yugoslavia that's really kind of playing both sides against the middle. But you don't have robust trade relationships with communist countries. And so a lot of these huge markets, the Soviet Union, China, those are going to be off the table,
yeah,
even though they're really not developed markets. So you've got to have a European market. And for the Republican side, it does us no good if we crater our economy, that's the only working capitalist economy in the world, to try to save a peripheral engagement.
Right.
That doesn't make sense.
Right. So we have talked on a prior podcast about why Eisenhower ran, kind of what his opinion of Korea was. So let's fast forward a little bit to he becomes president.
So, yes.
Early 53.
Yep.
He's inaugurated.
Mm-hmm.
This is great for the Army, right?
Yeah, one woman think. So one of the things that he thinks about is this great equation that you have to be secure,
mm-hmm,
but oftentimes when you think about security, we default to national security. And of course, Eisenhower, decades of experience in the Army, you would think that's how he internalizes national security, is in the land domain. And that is not the case. It's a holistic view of national security. So yes, military is going to be part of it, but economic security is the foundation of everything else. Because if you don't have an economy that's working, and when we talk about working, it's not just working to get U.S. tax dollars to military endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
It has to work for the people of the United States. And if that's not working, you don't have national security. And there's this, I don't know if y'all have talked about the idea of a garrison state. So
not really.
That's one of the big stalking horses for Eisenhower, is if you look at what happened in the Soviet Union, you have, you know, these series of five-year plans, and the idea is you have basically mobilized society, not in always in a military fashion, although that's what a lot of Soviet spending is going to be on. But you've mobilized the economy in a militaristic way to do things that aren't military specific. So we need to build a canal.
Right.
Got a great way to do it, right? We need to develop heavy manufacturing. Well, it doesn't matter that there's no demand for that. The central planners are going to dictate that that's what the economy does. And what Eisenhower doesn't want is for national security demands on the economy to force those centralized planners to dictate what the U.S. economy does. And that's the garrison state mentality. And he worries if you have military spending too much a part of your economy, if you misunderstand what makes the United States the United States. It's not just that it can produce whatever it needs to produce. It's how that economy is organized. And that economy is organized around individual autonomy, individual choice, and not centrally planned.
Right.
And so that's one of the things that he does not want to do. And if you just allow the military to say, oh, well, boss, we're going to need $70 billion. We thought it'd be 60. We need 70. He worries that you're going to have to militarize the economy and you're going to miss out. You're going to destroy what makes the United States the United States.
Which is interesting because he's coming from a war that required a militarized economy.
Yeah.
Things like price controls.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, Truman's going to do that again. You'll have price controls again in the Korean War. And you don't see a lot of criticism, a lot of backwards-looking criticism that price controls were bad in World War II. There's going to be some critiques of how the Truman administration organized, but not critiques necessarily from a principal perspective on price controls. It's more how that economy is being governed. And the worry is we see what it takes to do this for Korea. Mm-hmm. You got to have price controls. You have to dictate economic practices. And this is for a peripheral conflict.
Right.
What happens if it's even more than that?
Right, in Europe.
Europe or if you're Doug MacArthur, right?
Right.
What if we invade China?
Right.
And so for Eisenhower, you've got to have this hard line.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you escalate, you risk having to militarize your economy and you may never be able to get back from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the reasons why he's got this idea of a new look. That it doesn't come from this idea, but there's also a new European fashion trend of new look at the same time that the name kind of gets applied to it. But the idea is he's taking a new look at U.S. national security.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to happen in the summer of 1953. What's important about this is Stalin dies in the spring of 1953. Mm-hmm. And that seems to offer a lot of opportunity, except it doesn't. Right? So the Soviets are going to have a peace offensive. They're going to talk a lot about the fact that there really are no problems that cannot be addressed or resolved between the United States and the Soviet Union. And from the propaganda perspective, or rhetorical perspective, that seems to offer the hope of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Eisenhower's position and John Foster Dulles' position is, great, so show us. Right, it's one thing to talk about the importance of peace, how open you are. Have you given up occupation of Eastern European countries? Oh, you have not. Right? Have you stopped supporting the communists invading South Korea? Ah, yes, you also have not done that.
Right.
Right. So what Eisenhower continues to ask for are specific actions that will show that they are these peaceful rhetorical advances actually have something beneath them. And a little bit looking far afield, but you know, we haven't talked about atomic weapons specifically yet. So how do those come into the new look? In the summer of 1953, it looks like the Korean War is on its way out. You've been negotiating for a long time. The POW issue is the thing that's going to take the longest to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like you finally have the solution for that in the summer of 1953. But what if it happens again, right? What if the North Koreans get aggressive again? What do you do? What happens with Mao and China? Because there are going to be, you know, Taiwan is not a new problem, even though we talk about it much as it's a new problem. That is perennially an issue. So what do you do to make sure that the communists stay where they are? You've got NSC 68, which kind of lays the foundation of containment, but obviously in the wake of the Korean War, there's some good criticism. They didn't seem contained, right? Whatever we tried to do didn't necessarily work. So you have these three different ideas, and they assign guiding principles to each one of them. And so there's Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie. And Alpha is basically going to be containment as it is, focused less on militaristic containment, but more economics and trying to make sure that the Soviets stay where they are. B, and this is going to sound, you know, more of the same, but it's more militaristic. You're a little bit more overt in your threat about what happens if the Soviets get outside. So it's, think of the first one as kind of a line, but a line that you're not going to defend every inch of. Just so
this George Kennan.
Yeah, that's well, and so he's in charge of Task Force A. George Kennan is directed, you're going to lead this. And then Task Force B is the more militaristic. We're going to have this hard line they can't advance out of. And if they do, we're going to slap them down. And then Task Force C is rollback. We're actually going to take these newly occupied parts and we're going to push them back with the idea that these internal contradictions that are talked about with Kennan in the Long Telegram, that will just force pressure and that will cause a quicker collapse. Also cause the risk of escalated war, right? And so Eisenhower gets these three briefs, and it's called the Solarium Project. It doesn't happen in the Solarium Room. It actually takes place at the War College. But they're given lots of time. They're given lots of material. They're given very specific guidance about how to craft their proposals. And they all come back and they brief the National Security Council. And Eisenhower is dissatisfied. Like, oh, that's not what I... Because what he hoped is that these three different groups would all research their own directed course of action. And in the briefs and in kind of the sharing of ideas, they did form a consensus about which one was right, and they don't.
It sounds like Eisenhower thinks that politics works like a military staff. Am I reading that right?
That's actually one of the things that he does quite well. And I think, man, this is probably my own personal bias, but
it's all right.
He comes in and he finds a National Security Council that Truman creates, but it doesn't operate with any specific predictable routine. And so he looks at this staff process such as it is, and he says, hey, this is not going to work for me. Because you're right, he has spent decades in uniform with staffs that give him predictable products. You have regular meetings, and that's how he organizes his staff. And it works well as far as getting ideas, generating recommendations. I think there's also some good criticism for it in that national defense, while it seems like a staff would work well, sometimes that can narrow your options. But in want of a better solution, I think that it worked out well for him. So he does come in and he says, we're going to have some form for this. It's going to look like a military staff. We're going to have weekly meetings. He makes a lot of those. If he's not there, then Vice President will chair those meetings or another cabinet official. But it turns it from being not necessarily ad hoc, but less regular to this is something where all the principals are going to meet and we're going to have consistent updates and we're going to maintain kind of a through line of assessing the ever-changing national security environment.
So we've got kind of these pillars of national security now, and I think that maybe the two or maybe three main pillars are the economy, the conventional forces, mm-hmm. and the nuclear forces.
Yeah.
How does Eisenhower balance those?
Well, first of all, he thinks, and this is something that I find interesting in rhetoric, but hard in practice, in that he does not believe that there should be a difference in conventional and atomic forces. He says that to speak of them as if they were different things misunderstands what they are. It's easy to say that. It is hard, in fact, to act as if that were the case. But that's his constant rejoinder when they're talking about atomic weapons, conventional weapons. He says, no, we just have weapons. And our weapons are weapons, and we need to treat them all as if they're all the same. Yeah, right. So, but you're right. There are kind of three pillars. One that you didn't discuss, I mean, it makes sense because you don't see it. It's the covert part of it. And that's something that we don't think about as much just because there's some distasteful aspects, but you're going to have a covert coup mm-hmm. in Iran. Mm-hmm. You're going to have the CIA doing something similar in Guatemala. You have these covert actions in European politics, as we talked about, to make sure that communist socialist parties don't win. They have pluralities, but you don't want them to be outright majorities, because the worry is if they take over a parliament, that will be the last election. They'll never allow another free, open election again.
Right.
So Eisenhower sees covert actions, whether that's through the CIA, whether that's through other organizations. That is a way to put your thumb on the scale and hopefully not be as escalatory. Conventional forces, the problem with them is, one, they're incredibly expensive. Two, they are, by their nature, escalatory. Mm-hmm. Atomic weapons also have their own problems, in that in the early part, so 1953, you know, we think of things as a triad. You really just have one, right? It's manned aircraft. That's how you're getting these weapons across. And even that, you don't have inter-air refueling until the latter part of the 1950s. So if you're going to do something where you're actually attacking, all right, well, you got to have forward deployed bases, or you're sending folks on one-way missions where they're going to take off in the continent of the United States, fly over the Arctic Circle, hit the Soviet Union, and then land somewhere in a NATO-friendly country. But that still means you have to have forward deployed airstrips, because these aren't airframes that can land on unimproved airstrips.
Yeah.
So even though there's talk of conventional and atomic being the same thing, from a policy standpoint, we'll see that's not really the case, and definitely not the case in terms of resource allocation. That's because the Army is going to suffer a lot.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. The way we teach this period here at the Command and General Staff College is Eisenhower is kind of enchanted by the Air Force, by the nuclear capabilities of the Air Force. Yeah. He has very little time for conventional land warfare.
Yeah.
Is that correct, and how does that actually play out?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that he's necessarily enchanted by the Air Force. So that has this connotation of it's a bright, shiny object, and he's overawed with it. I think, honestly, it's his understanding of Clausewitz. And this is something that is a little frustrating. So there's a general named Fox Connor that mentors Eisenhower. And he really has – Eisenhower serves with him as a junior officer, and – Fox Connor has his professional reading list, includes On War, and it's not just, as we often treat the Chief of Staff's reading list as, well, that's interesting, but nobody ever reads anything on it. No, Eisenhower and General Connor have a lot of discussions on these books, and so, hey, Ike, you're going to read this thing? Great. Next week, I want you to come talk to me about it. So On War is formative for him, and one of the things that he gets from it is – we just taught Clausewitz this week, and you know, we've got the bumper sticker wars, continuation of politics by other means. It's trite, it is surface level, but at the end of the day, war is about an objective. Mm-hmm. And so what Eisenhower wants to do is, how can you make the risk of war so great that the objective, whatever it is, won't be worth it? And the way that he tries to do that is with atomic weapons.
Yeah, and this is Clausewitz's idea of the value of the object.
Yeah.
Which is not original to him, but a lot of people know it from there.
Right. And so if we can make sure that whatever means we have at our disposal will make it so the enemy and their calculus won't be able to rationalize that risk, then we won't have war. Mm-hmm. And so it is containment and it is deterrence, but it's inelegant. It's not mutually assured destruction. It's not escalated or graduated deterrence. John Foster Dulles is going to characterize it in early 1954, massive retaliation, right? And that kind of gets a bad rap, because the bumper sticker is, well, the United States is going to nuke Moscow if the Soviets do anything. And that's not a completely inaccurate read, but it's also not a completely true understanding of what he was saying. What he was saying was the United States withholds the right to determine when, where, and how it will respond to Soviet aggression. So we have in our current principles of war proportionality as a principle, that whatever the enemy does, we should respond in a way that correlates to that. That is not something the Eisenhower administration felt constrained by.
Right. So,
and the idea was, if we could take proportionality out, and proportionality, it's not as if it was there and they removed it. That is an accretion that we've applied later. So it's not as if they're acting against any type of code of ethics. But the idea is, if we can take that predictability, that if the Soviets are going to use small incursions, and we look at small incursions on a global scale, what happens in the Korean Peninsula is relatively small.
Yeah.
That can't go unaddressed, but do we have to reply by mobilizing ground divisions, sending them halfway across the world, having a line of communication that supports those for years, mm-hmm. take tens of thousands of casualties, have these extremely attenuated peace negotiations,
right.
just so we can, what, return to the status quo?
Right.
That seems, to be callous with it, it's a resource inefficient way to solve that security problem.
Yeah.
And so what the Eisenhower administration does is lets the world know, specifically the Soviet Union, it does not feel bound to respond in kind. And so just take that for what it's worth. You have a small incursion somewhere. We may not respond in a way that addresses that immediate concern, because they're trying to put everything in a global context.
So let's talk about one of your specialties as a researcher. How does the advent of missile technology change this picture?
Not much, no. So it seems to offer some options. The problem, though, is the United States in the beginning of the decade, so much of this is because we don't know what the Soviets are doing.
Right.
And we hear what they're doing. We kind of have some ideas based on some of our intelligence, but we don't have on-the-ground sources mm-hmm. in any robust capacity. So we
the
don't
way the Soviets do in America.
Yes, that's a good point. Yes, the Soviet intelligence operation is quite good. We just don't have anything to that scale. And so what we get, we know that the Soviets have a core of German rocket scientists, because we have the other part of that, right?
Right.
We know that the Soviets, especially when Khrushchev consolidates his power, he is going to double down on rocketry to the point that they create a Soviet rocket force in the way that in 1947 we create an air force. The Soviets are going to have a missile force. Mm. And so just organizationally, you don't have to be a genius to go, okay, well, they care about these things. They're going to develop long-range bombers, but not to the degree the United States does. They're going to really focus on missiles. And for a while, we feel behind the power curve. That's really going to be a problem with Sputnik, where it seems that they've got this great leap on us. That's not necessarily the case. So what happens with missile development through the 1950s is it puts you in awkward situations more than it solves your problems. And what I mean by that is the first things we're going to have are intermediate-range ballistic missiles, medium-range ballistic missiles. The Army's going to have shorter-range ballistic missiles. The problem with all those short-range ballistic missiles is you have to put them forward deployed.
Right.
Well, that's all well and good, but if you put something forward, how do you defend that thing? Well,
right.
Now you have to have security forces around there, and it's going to require you to have on-the-ground forces in an enduring capacity. When one of the things that Eisenhower wants desperately to do is withdraw. We talked about those four divisions they mobilized for Korea. That was supposed to be an urgent response to an urgent crisis. And so what Eisenhower wants to do is withdraw them. The problem is, as you start to build more U.S. security infrastructure there, that's a problem.
Right.
Also, the Europeans, there are a lot of promises about what NATO is supposed to have, 50 divisions.
Yeah, right.
They never have 50 divisions.
They might have five.
Yeah, right. And the problem is, four of those are U.S.
Yep.
So how do you remove these divisions out of Europe without sparking fear in your European allies that you're abandoning this project? Because the other side of that is the U.S. offer, especially for Eisenhower, would be, that's okay because we have this nuclear umbrella, which is all well and good, except where those missiles are going to fall are going to be in Eastern
right.
Europe, Central Europe, Western Europe. That doesn't sell well.
Right.
And so these missiles, you have to have them to develop options. Everybody needs options. But the first set of missiles are going to be land-based, and the Air Force wants them to be in hardened launch facilities, which are easily seen. the Navy and the Army are going to have a joint project, and that's actually going to be quite good when the Navy leaves the Army to develop their own solid fuel ballistic missile, and that is going to be the Polaris. Mm. And when you get that in the late 1950s, early 1960s, as far as an operational program, now you have submarines. And that is something that really does answer the mail as far as giving you not only options, but giving you options that don't require significant security footprints. And mm-hmm. they're always mobile.
That's fair, yes. Yeah. So it sounds like the picture you're painting is one where the Air Force and the Navy have kind of become the center of gravity of the U.S.'s defense posture, and the Army is being left behind.
Well, here's the irony. The Army actually has a very successful missile program. Wernher von Braun is, we talked about those German scientists, he's our guy. Distasteful Nazi past as it may be,
yep.
You know, we got to make awkward compromises. And his Jupiter program is very successful. In fact, more successful than the Air Force's Thor program. And these missiles, they're multi-stage, and he is specifically disallowed in 1956 from having an active fourth stage. This won't happen. And then when the Soviets have their Sputnik success, he is just apoplectic. He said, I could have done that months before, but you told me not to. And the reason he couldn't is because we talk about these interdepartmental squabbles. Eisenhower wants to economize spending. Mm-hmm. And in the early part, this is a little bit of irony, in the early part of the missile program, you put a whole bunch of money into a whole different whole series of parallel development efforts because you don't really know who's going to pan out.
Right. It's kind of a classic venture capital strategy.
Exactly. Yeah. And that could be more resource efficient than putting all your money in one bad bet.
Yeah.
And the Air Force, their foundational idea is we're going to start with the idea of getting an intercontinental ballistic missile. But to do that, we're going to have to build smaller stages, get those perfected, and then move on. The Army, under Wernher von Braun, starts out with kind of a robust V-2. And then there's the Corporal, which is a pretty good short-range missile. And the idea is we've got this good infrastructure. Why don't we just kind of make it bigger and make it go longer? And that's what they do. And it's actually really successful, much more so in terms of successful test flights, getting stage developments. That works. But the Army does not have an operational need for a 1,000-mile missile.
You anticipated my question. Why yeah. does the Army need long-range missiles?
Yeah. Well, if you listen to General Gavin, who is the flag officer. So General Gavin, paratrooper in World War II. After World War II, he's going to get into the Army missile program, and he is the guy kind of leading this research effort in a Pentagon level, not in a technical sense. And his idea is that 1,000-mile, it does not make sense if you're thinking about these missiles being behind the frontline trace of operational units. Yeah, because that's too far inland.
Yeah.
The Army doesn't have it. They have a Key West Agreement. I don't know if y'all talked about that in the podcast, but in the post-World War II period, when you create the Department of Defense and now you have an Air Force, you have a Navy, you have an Army, they have to figure out, well, how do we kind of slice up these operational roles and responsibilities. So they all get together at Key West and they say, okay, well, the Air Force is going to have all fixed wing stuff and the Army can have some rotary wing aviation, but they really can't have any fixed wing stuff. Then they've got these delineations of the battlefield. So what we would look at from the ground force is a deep fight is not deep by the Air Force definition.
Yeah.
And so those really deep strategic targets, the Air Force by statute is the one that can target them. And also they control all the air stuff. Well, what Gavin's looking at is how can we have protected long-range fires for the frontline trace? Well, one way is you put your, this is going to sound funny, we're going to put these missiles in North Africa. And then they can hit, you know, Central Europe, Eastern Europe if we have to fight. Also, what Gavin wants is mobile launchers, which from an operational security standpoint makes a lot of sense as far as targeting.
Right.
The problem is these are liquid-fueled missiles, and you can't just let the liquid fuel sit because it's corrosive. and it'll ruin your missiles. So it takes hours. So they're mobile. Not
I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we did have scare quotes in mind. We say mobile because once you get the coordinates and you start the firing process, you are locked in for hours to get the missile up, to get the liquid fuel, because it's liquid oxygen, and then you've got the oxidizers in there. So these things have to be kept in incredibly cold conditions, and fueling is not an easy process. Yeah. So
you can't offload that to the
No, right. And security contractors aren't necessarily going to be excited for that job either.
Yeah. So the Army does have, as you mentioned, this kind of advanced missile technology.
Mm-hmm.
But as you also mentioned, by statute, the Army deals with a closer fight, if
you
want to characterize it that way. So what's happening to the Army in the late 50s? When Matthew Ridgway kind of gets crossways with Eisenhower, then Maxwell Taylor comes in, we have the Pentomic Division.
Mm-hmm. Ridgway is an interesting... It would seem that Ridgway and Eisenhower, not that they were necessarily close friends, but they should have a lot of professional affinity.
Yeah.
Both have experience in World War II. Ridgway has success in Korea. And it would seem that as Chief of Staff of the Army, serving a General of the Army President, that they should work together. The problem is this idea of loyalty. And what does the Chief of Staff of the Army owe the President? And what does the Chief of Staff of the Army owe Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Ridgway, as you get to the latter part of the 1950s, mass retaliation starts to lose its shine. And to be fair, throughout the Eisenhower administration, the Army is skeptical of what Eisenhower is doing because he wants to reduce defense spending. Not fighting Korea is going to help you, but you don't really reduce the top line defense budget as much. Before Korea, $14 billion is what the DoD budget is supposed to be, and they submit a budget for that, and then Korea happens and it quadruples. So you'd think, well, okay, if it quadruples with Korea, then you know maybe it goes down. It really never goes down significantly below what it was in Korea, just because that mobilization is not for Korea specifically, it's for the Cold War, which is now militarized. And the devil in the details of these missiles is, while they're not manpower intensive, it doesn't, you know, a division's 20,000 folks, a missile doesn't take 20,000 people, they are wildly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have one generation of intercontinental ballistic missiles, well, you can't just say, well, that's going to solve all of our security problems. You have to have a next generation. And then you start to have discussions of, well, what does defense look like in this? Well, defense is not just having one fleet of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Defense at this time, because you don't have an effective anti-ballistic missile program yet, is the manned bombers that we still have with Strategic Air Command. And then by the late 1950s, you have the Polaris subs. Now, that gives the Navy a good job, it gives the Air Force two good jobs, and the Army is left twiddling its thumbs. So what is the Army supposed to do? And what Eisenhower thinks the Army would be good for is keeping the peace in the aftermath of a nuclear attack in the United States, which is a distasteful security responsibility and also one that doesn't get much of a budget. So what the Army's trying to do with things like the Pentomic Division is make a play that it can fight on an atomic battlefield. And it can use these atomic weapons and fight conventional wars. Where that rubs Ridgway the wrong way is it doesn't address the spectrum of how would we talk about it today, this continuum of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It really puts a lot of favor on the high end,
mm-hmm.
with very little concern on brushfire wars. That's how they talk about insurgencies or things like what will be Vietnam. Taylor's going to call them brushfire wars. Ridgway's going to talk about peripheral conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army is well suited for that. But that's not something the Eisenhower administration cares about.
Right.
And so Congress calls Ridgway to testify. That's part of their oversight role. And Ridgway, you know, they ask him, okay, well, hey, as Chief of Staff of the Army, do you have any concerns about this new look security policy, about what the Eisenhower administration is doing? And he says, well, here I am, Chief of Staff of the Army. I owe Congress my professional military opinion. My professional military opinion is yeah, we are underwriting some serious risk. And Eisenhower believes that's insubordinate. And this is where there's a really good conversation about where those loyalties lie. As a member of the executive branch, he's chief of staff of the Army, serving at the president's pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
He's a member of the administration. However, his commission is not to Eisenhower. Right now, the president gives him his commission, but his oath is to defend the Constitution.
Right.
So Ridgway sees this as him being loyal, that Congress asked me my professional opinion. I don't have to be a shill for the administration. For Eisenhower, though, you are chief of staff of the Army in my administration.
Yeah.
My administration's position is this does not incur significant risk.
And they can both be right.
They can be, yes. But that's that tension. Eisenhower, right. For Eisenhower, he doesn't live in a world where they're both right. You know, he's like, oh, well, Matt, we'll agree to disagree in this one. He sees it as insubordination.
Right.
Because, and it's not
it,
that.
I mean, it kind of is, but it's also kind of not wrong.
No. And this, I think this is a great, real question about what a profession means and where those loyalties lie.
Mm-hmm.
In that, and it's a little. Ridgway's not going to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs just because, like, it's not the Army's turn, and he's not. When he gets the job of Chief of Staff of the Army, that's never going to happen, right? He knows that. So there's really no other position that he's going to go to. He'd already been SACUR. He'd already commanded in Korea. What else do you do?
Right.
So, and I don't want to minimize his display of loyalty. I think it's laudable. But it's also the case that, you know, professionally, he's not necessarily risking a lot. But I do think that it is narrow-minded. Yeah, okay. It's a narrow read of loyalty from Eisenhower's perspective that he can't understand. Congress has, as its own independent branch of government, a duty for oversight.
Right.
And Congress is owed military officers' professional judgment. That's what they got.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Now, it happens to go against your administration. So be it. You know, sometimes the people, and not that Ridgway was bought, but like, you know, sometimes people you buy don't stay bought.
Right.
But what would you expect of an officer who respects his oath to the Constitution?
Right.
You would want them to honor that in the way that they feel they need to.
Right.
So
Ridgway is kind of shuffled off. Maxwell Taylor takes his place. And this Pentomic Division is still hanging around. So what is that Pentomic Division? What's it look like?
It's awkward. So there are five battle groups, and the idea is you move away. The Army is always trying to, in the post-war period, trying to figure out, well, what works? Because you have the triangular division of World War II, and there's an idea necessarily that doesn't quite seem right. You have basically that similar division that's going to fight in Korea. The Pentomic Division is a wild departure from that you move from 3 to 5. You're supposed to have a lot more mobility assets. Each division, depending on the type of division, because they're still going to be airborne, they're still going to be armored, still going to be infantry, but they're going to have some complement to some degree of an organic atomic capacity. Oftentimes, that's going to be pretty low yield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think kind of Davy Crockett, atomic Annie, the atomic artillery piece, not 20 kilotons, definitely not, you know, a megaton warhead, but things that will allow that division to use an atomic blast instead of, you know, an artillery battalion.
So these are a fire brigade.
They can be, but they're really more in terms, the idea of a Pentomic force is, this will make sense in 21st century context, you mass effects. So you're going to mass fires, and hopefully the enemy will mass its troops, and you can use your mass effects to create a lot of casualties. How much is that going to work out? Well, the problem is the Pentomic Division, a lot of our listeners probably won't know about future combat systems, but go Google future combat systems. The idea with the Pentomic Army is improved mobility with things like rotary-wing aircraft, which when we talked about Key West, that really had not seen its maturity yet, because that's before the Korean War. Korean War, you have a lot of rotary-wing aircraft, especially we know MASH and Medevac.
Right.
But as the 50s go on, it seems like that's much more of a mature technology. So that's going to allow a lot more operational mobility, wheeled vehicles, track vehicles that can be sealed from radiation, and improved communication technology that's going to allow these commanders to control and coordinate their disparate five battle groups and then rapidly consolidate them either in physical space or with effects, and then just as rapidly disperse them. Because the worry that everybody has on an atomic battlefield is if you consolidate, well, the enemy is going to hit you with a nuclear weapon. Right? Mm-hmm. That's true because that's what our doctrine is based on.
It's also what we're planning
to do. Yeah, exactly. The problem is you never really have the robust transportation equipment that comes to the fore. You never have the robust communication technology that would allow you to effectively coordinate. And then there's just people. When we talk about span of control, all the students are kind of thinking of five. Five seems like an awkward number. Yeah, that's a lot to try to keep in one commander's mind. And these five battle groups would also have their five battalions and those five. But everything is kind of fives. And the idea is they're smaller than regular companies, smaller than regular platoons, but that mobility will allow them to consolidate as necessary to fight as they need to and then rapidly disperse. But if you have trouble keeping track of three, four, five is going to rapidly outstrip. And this is a time you don't have all of the pieces of technology we have to keep folks' location on a map. You know, there is no CPCE at the time. Everything is analog equipment, and you're having to rely on communication technology that is promised to be much more effective, but it's not. You're still dealing with what you have, which the requirements are outstripped. The requirements outstrip what actually is available.
So this sounds like it was a good idea on paper, but didn't quite work out in reality.
You know, that's one of the things that I think is, Andrew Bacevich has a book, The Potomac Era, that's pretty good. It's quite good about specifically what's going on in the Potomac Era. Elvis's Army by Brian Lynn is a fascinating discussion of what's going on through the Army in the 1950s. And I think the issue is, this is an organizational response. You have to do something.
Right.
And maybe you can't do what you need to do, but you have to show you're playing the game. And if the coin of the realm is atomic weapons, you have to get those not just at a core level, which we talked about Gavin's view of these long-range missiles. Those would be core or field army assets.
Right.
This is a way to get divisions. And, you know, the Army's kind of coming back to the division as a unit of employment. The division is how the Army fights in the 1950s. And if you can make these divisions organically atomic, mm-hmm. then the idea is that will resonate in these conversations about the importance of atomic capability. How feasible it is or not is less of a concern because you are speaking in the language that senior leaders appreciate.
And Congress will appropriate funds for.
Yeah. That's the hope, and that's one of the interesting things with the consolidation of the Department of Defense. And I haven't done as much research on this as I need to, but you know, before you had a Department of War and a Department of the Navy, and then you had those respective committees, and mm-hmm. those respective committees could be very amenable to the needs of their respective departments. So the House, you know, Committee on War, and okay. Well, now that you have a Department of Defense, you have a House Armed Services Committee, you have a Senate Armed Services Committee. And instead of the Chief of Staff of the Army going to the Committee for the Department of War in Congress, they're going, but oftentimes it's the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. By exception, sometimes it's the Chief of Staff, but they're addressing a combined committee.
Right.
And so these appeals for equitable funding kind of sometimes fall on deaf ears because right. and Congress is saying, well, at the end of the day, we're going to be spending money. We just may not be spending money on you.
Right.
The other thing that the Army, this is a fascinating understanding of what happens inside, and also we haven't talked about his farewell address, but right. it'll lead us to that. So the Air Force uses defense contractors masterfully. If you look at who's making these missiles for them, who's researching and developing their jets, defense contractors. And defense contractors do one thing. They do several things well, but they do one thing really well, and that is they lobby Congress. And so the Air Force can lobby Congress, and their defense contractors can lobby Congress. The Army has defense contractors. It's not that they don't. It's that they don't have as robust of an operation that gets those defense contractors out there beating feet to make sure Congress understands the importance of sending money for that Army program. And so you see a little bit of jealousy from the Army. Oh, man, that's like a good program. Why didn't we do that? But then, you know, we see Eisenhower in his farewell address, he talks about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. And one of the things that it's easy to see, okay, well, he's talking about defense contractors. Yes, but he's also talking about academia. And what he sees is you start to have a defense industry that did not exist in the way that it does in the Cold War. And it's not just defense contractors. It's those and academics, people in RAND, that are really making policy, but they're not accountable.
Yeah.
And that's his concern. It's, yes, this is all problems of fiscal management, but if you've outsourced your policy formation to academics, to defense contractors, their priorities are going to be very different. And also, there's no direct way for the American people to come and take issue with their policies.
Yeah.
They can only elect office holders. And that's what Eisenhower really worried about, is if you look at who's starting to write about strategy. Prior to the Cold War, you don't have as much academic interest in it because there's no money in it, right? All of a sudden, there's a ton of money in it, and now you have a lot more academic interest, and not just in physics or in things that would make sense from a manufacturing perspective, but you know, security studies. That is not a thing that existed prior to the Cold War. It doesn't exist at this time, as it were, but you start to see the beginnings of those companies, of those of those departments, and of that idea that, hey, there's actually good funding for research in this. And not to take anything away from security studies folks, but the problem is, if you've got these think tanks that are beholden to military branches in the way that RAND is beholden to the Air Force, how much of their research is objective?
Right.
How much of their research is just servicing the needs of that individual service? And if those defense contractors are going to Congress and starting to let congressional representatives know, well, it's really important that we have this missile. Well, why? Well, look at all the jobs. If you look at where defense manufacturing happens, it's very dispersed, right?
Yeah.
So that's what Eisenhower is worried about, is the system of government that we have can morph. Yeah, people still go and they'll still vote, but those votes will have less and less effect on the policy. And we talked about the garrison state. As the military, what he's worried about is the military becomes more and more important in the economy, they can become more and more dictatorial, and it will take away the ability of the American people to make choices for themselves.
That's fascinating. So what would you say a modern listener, maybe a modern student here, should take away from this period?
Read your Clausewitz. No.
That's always the answer.
Yeah. So I think Eisenhower is trying to solve a ridiculously difficult problem. And you know, sometimes people talk about squaring the circle. That's an impossible. You can't square a circle, right? It is an impossible geometric construction. And that's what Eisenhower is faced with. It's an impossible problem. Because the real issue is, he doesn't want to spend money on all this stuff. But the Soviets refuse to allow inspections. The Soviets refuse to abide by, from a U.S. perspective, international agreements that they've signed on to. They refuse to make meaningful gestures that will move us towards de-escalation, or what we'll see is détente.
Mm-hmm.
So in the absence of all of this, you know that the Soviets are investing a large portion of their economy in their military. You know that they have hundreds of divisions. You know that, and again, this is from Eisenhower's perspective, you know that they are militaristic. So what do? Well, you have to prepare. You have to do something. I think one of the things that he does not do as well is he doesn't ask himself, what don't I know? And so he has this view that it's his atomic threats that largely end the Korean War. it's not that. It's the fact that, I mean, things in China are not going well.
Right.
And Mao has to consolidate his control because 49, he wins. But 50, he's going to be drawn into this war that doesn't want to fight. The Soviets are still struggling. What does the economy look like? And they've got a whole host of problems. So especially after the death of Stalin, the triumvirate that's ruling, they want out. But they got to get the Chinese communists to also get out. So it's not atomic bluster from the U.S. that solves this problem. It's more problems inside the socialist world. How much of that could he know? Probably not as much as he needed. But I feel like he could have asked himself, you know, what are the things I don't know that I need to know? And be a little bit more diligent in trying to find that out instead of thinking, well, the Soviets, they're always militaristic, they're always expansionist, they hate us, and they want to destroy us. All of those things may be true, but it doesn't mean that they're as aggressive as you into it.
Sounds like he should also have read some George Kennan.
Yeah, George Kennan is kind of persona non grata. He and Dulles don't necessarily get along.
Yeah. No, this has been a fascinating discussion, Dr. Brown. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.